What if I told you that the world's most violent criminal organizations operate with the same business principles as Fortune 500 companies? That's the startling revelation at the heart of Tom Wainwright's groundbreaking investigation. Standing in Ciudad Juarez, once the murder capital of the world, Wainwright discovered that beneath the bloodshed lies a sophisticated global industry worth $300 billion annually, equivalent to one of the world's 40 largest economies. This isn't just another sensationalized account of cartel violence. It's an economist's dissection of how drug lords manage supply chains like Walmart, expand through franchising like McDonald's, and worry about customer service like Amazon. The book has become required reading in business schools and intelligence agencies alike, praised by figures ranging from the former president of Mexico to the head of the DEA. What makes it so compelling is how it flips conventional wisdom. What if the solution to the drug war isn't more guns and prisons, but better economics? The journey of cocaine from South American jungle to American nostril represents one of the most remarkable value chains in any global industry. The process begins with farmers harvesting coca leaves, which are dried from 1 ton down to about 300 kilograms. These dried leaves are then chopped and mixed with cement, fertilizer, and gasoline to extract the cocaine alkaloid. After filtering and removing chemicals, the residue is boiled down to produce approximately 1 kilogram of cocaine base. This base is further refined with acetone and hydrochloric acid to create the final product, pure cocaine hydrochloric powder. What's fascinating is how cartels continuously innovate this process. Recent improvements include using ovens instead of sun-drying, gasoline-powered hedge trimmers for chopping leaves, and modified washing machines as primitive centrifuges. Some labs even operate from trucks moving along jungle back roads to avoid detection. These innovations have doubled cocaine yields in Bolivia over just 3 years. The economics of this supply chain reveal why anti-drug policies so often fail. By the time cocaine reaches American streets, its value has increased by a staggering 30,000% from raw materials. Yet law enforcement focuses heavily on eradicating coca plants, the least valuable part of the chain. This would be like trying to bankrupt Apple by raising the price of the sand used in making silicon chips. The markup happens primarily during transportation across borders, not during production. When authorities in Tijuana burned 134 metric tons of seized marijuana, they claimed it was worth $340 million. But basic economics shows this figure was absurdly inflated. The actual loss to cartels was likely under $10 million, less than 3% of the reported value. This wholesale-to-retail accounting trick makes seizures look impressive while having minimal impact on cartel operations. Understanding this value chain explains why the war on supply has been so ineffective. Even if coca leaf prices doubled or tripled due to eradication efforts, the impact on final street prices would be negligible, like raising the cost of coffee beans by $1 and expecting your Starbucks latte to increase by the same amount. The real profits and the real opportunity for disruption lie much further down the supply chain. Why do some drug markets erupt in horrific violence while others remain relatively peaceful? The answer lies in basic economic principles of competition versus collusion, a stark contrast illustrated by comparing Mexico and El Salvador. Under President Felipe Calderón, Mexico's murder rate doubled despite the capture or killing of 25 of the country's 37 most wanted cartel leaders. Meanwhile, El Salvador saw its murder rate drop by two-thirds when rival gangs Mara Salvatrucha and Barrio 18 unexpectedly declared a truce. This difference reveals how market conditions dramatically affect violence levels. Ciudad Juarez exemplifies the competitive model. Its strategic value comes from being a gateway to America's drug market. The DEA estimates 70% of cocaine entering the U.S. via Mexico crosses at Juarez. Post-9/11 border tightening made each crossing point more valuable, as the 2,000-mile frontier has only 47 official crossings. This scarcity creates something worth fighting for. The Juarez cartel's decline began after its leader, Amado, Lord of the Skies, Carrillo Fuentes, died during plastic surgery in 1997. Sensing weakness, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman targeted Juarez with his Sinaloa cartel. Like corporate takeovers thwarted by regulators, El Chapo faced resistance from Juarez's corrupt local police who were loyal to the Carrillo Fuentes organization. His solution was appealing to different regulators, the federal police. This created absurd situations where different police forces fought each other while serving rival cartels. By contrast, El Salvador's gangs opted for collusion. The two main Maras, Mara Salvatrucha and Barrio 18, originated in California prisons before being re-exported to Central America through deportations. In March 2012, their leaders agreed to a truce, ending decades of murderous conflict. The truce made economic sense. By dividing territories into uncontested sectors, each gang could operate local monopolies without costly competition. Unlike Mexican cartels fighting over scarce border crossings, El Salvador's gangs could easily partition their domestic extortion and drug markets. The result was dramatic. The murder rate fell by two-thirds almost overnight. Though the truce eventually collapsed when President Salvador Sanchez Seren withdrew support, it demonstrated how market structure influences violence. In Mexico, competition for limited border crossings drives bloodshed. Counterintuitively, opening more crossings could reduce violence by making each less valuable to fight over, with minimal impact on the American drug market. Additionally, consolidating Mexico's fragmented police forces would prevent cartels from co-opting different agencies. These examples demonstrate that governments should consider shaping criminal markets rather than simply battling to shut them down at any cost. Understanding the economics of violence offers more effective strategies than endless enforcement. Despite their enormous profits, drug cartels face critical human resources challenges that undermine their operations. Consider the UK drug importer whose $300,000 deal collapsed when his driver photographed himself with the cash during mad, passionate love with his girlfriend. When the driver's jealous wife discovered the affair, she tipped off border police, resulting in his arrest. Such soap opera lifestyles frequently lead to traffickers' downfall. Cartels struggle with two fundamental HR problems: recruiting trustworthy workers in a secretive industry with high turnover due to arrests and deaths, and managing relationships without legal contract enforcement. Violence becomes their only enforcement mechanism, though it's expensive and disruptive to business. Prisons inadvertently serve as perfect recruitment centers for criminal organizations. Carlos Lader's story illustrates this perfectly. Imprisoned for auto theft, he met George Jung, who knew how to smuggle drugs by plane. Together, after their 1976 release, they revolutionized cocaine trafficking, partnering with Pablo Escobar's Medellin cartel. Lader called Danbury Prison his college, highlighting how jails function as criminal HR departments, places full of potential recruits with nothing to do and no future prospects. Some criminal organizations have developed sophisticated solutions to these challenges. La Nuestra Familia, a California prison gang founded in the 1960s, demonstrates remarkable organizational design. With approximately 500 core members and 1,000 affiliates, the gang solved the collective action problem through an elaborate constitution. Their four-tier hierarchy includes checks and balances, preventing senior members from exploiting juniors. Even the lowest-ranking members can report abuses, the general can be impeached, and captains are elected by rank-and-file members. After a 1978 embezzlement scandal, they replaced the general position with a three-person organizational governing body requiring two-thirds majority for decisions. Unlike the formal gang structures in Latin America, drug trafficking organizations in wealthy countries often operate with minimal full-time staff, using freelancers instead. One British cocaine operation, generating $60 million annually, was run by just two people who hired contractors for specific roles: couriers, money collectors, counters, and drivers. Most cartels specialize in specific supply chain segments rather than controlling the entire process, creating business-to-business relationships that require surprising diplomacy. Many criminal organizations organize along racial or ethnic lines, using family ties as insurance against betrayal. The Colombian money smuggling operation in the Netherlands deliberately hired only Colombian nationals, collecting family information to enable revenge if anyone absconded with the money. Similarly, Mexican heroin cartels send Mexican nationals to manage U.S. distribution, despite higher costs, because they can threaten families back home. The Dominican Republic's prison reform demonstrates that humane facilities can disrupt this criminal HR pipeline. Their model prisons isolate gang leaders, ban cell phones, provide education and vocational training, and employ specially trained civilian staff earning triple the salary of traditional guards. Though expensive at $12 per prisoner daily, double the old system's cost, the reform reduced recidivism from 50% to under 3%. Making prisons less brutal removes inmates' need for gang protection and hampers cartel recruitment. Just as Dutch dealer Pete maintained relationships with unreliable contacts because finding new ones was too risky. When Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was arrested in February 2014, thousands marched in Sinaloa not to condemn the vicious kingpin, but to celebrate him, wearing shirts declaring, "Shorty is more loved than politicians," and chanting, "Que viva El Chapo!" Despite ordering thousands of murders, Guzman enjoyed surprising popularity. A nationwide poll showed only 53% approved of his arrest, while 28% disapproved. This curious popularity represents one of business's most dramatic PR coups. In 2010, as the battle between the Sinaloa cartel and the Juarez organization intensified, professionally printed banners called Narcomantas began appearing across Ciudad Juarez. One such message, purportedly from El Chapo himself, proclaimed, "I do not order the killing of children and women. I do not condone extortion or kidnapping." The banner blamed rival group La Línea for destroying the state and killing people for mere 1,000 pesos in extortion payments, establishing a code of conduct that positioned Sinaloa as the more ethical criminal enterprise. Cartels take marketing extremely seriously. Public support helps fugitives evade capture, so they employ elaborate methods to polish their image. Just as legitimate businesses have shifted from traditional advertising to PR, cartels focus on controlling editorial content rather than just posting banners, recognizing that news coverage carries more weight than paid messaging. In Reynosa, cartels have created a complete news blackout through intimidation. When I visited, one local journalist had been murdered and five had vanished in just 2 months. The traditional cartel approach of plata or plomo, silver or lead, bribe or bullet, has effectively silenced reporting. Journalist Jose Vladimir Antuna was found murdered with a note, "This happened to me for passing information to soldiers and for writing what shouldn't be written." Cartels target two key audiences with their propaganda. First, the general public. Convincing them that rival cartels are more violent and corrupt discourages citizens from reporting their activities to authorities. Second, the government. Preventing news coverage of violence means fewer troops will be dispatched to troubled areas. Cartels sometimes even remove their dead after shootouts to minimize evidence of violence. Conversely, they sometimes deliberately heat up a plaza, calentar la plaza, by dumping bodies in public places to provoke government crackdowns in rivals' territories. The cartel's media control weakens online. Anonymous sites like El Blog del Narco publish news too dangerous for mainstream outlets. Cartels have responded with violence, hanging bodies with warning signs against internet gossips, killing bloggers, and offering large rewards for identifying anonymous reporters. Drug cartels have also embraced corporate social responsibility with surprising enthusiasm. From Shorty Guzman's $1,000 tips to Pablo Escobar's housing projects, narco-philanthropy builds community support. Some priests accept these donations, reasoning that money can be purified through good intentions. The strategy is simple. The more people who benefit from a cartel's presence, the stronger their protection from authorities. Cartels strategically fill institutional voids where governments fail to deliver services. Criminal groups enforce illegal agreements between businesses, as seen with Italian mafia regulating Sicilian millers and New York garbage collection. By making charitable donations, providing services in neglected areas, and forging links with businesses, cartels soften their image and reduce chances of being reported. Governments can counter these tactics by improving public services, strengthening competition investigations, and protecting journalists. Just as legitimate businesses moved operations overseas to cut costs in the late 20th century, drug cartels have followed the same offshoring strategy. Central America serves as a trampoline for drug shipments, with 80% of cocaine entering the United States passing through this narrow isthmus. Rather than merely using these countries as transit points, Mexican traffickers are now establishing permanent operations there, setting up cocaine processing labs and bringing their brutal violence to the region. The cartels have discovered that offshoring provides abundant cheap labor. In Guatemala City, teenagers like Jose begin criminal careers at shockingly young ages. He started as a hitman at just 8 years old after his father was murdered. With average incomes in Guatemala $3,500 a year and Nicaragua under $2,000, far below Mexico's $10,000, cartels can hire workers cheaply. Even more valuable are ex-members of Guatemala's feared special forces, the Caibiles, who committed atrocities during the Civil War and now find employment with drug traffickers. Guatemala's government has been systematically hollowed out, with the army reduced from 30,000 to just 10,000 soldiers, leaving only 32 troops to patrol a 200-mile stretch of the Mexican border. The cartels exploit this weakness, setting up bases in northern Guatemala and using it like an international airport. The state's inability to meet basic needs stems from collecting minimal taxes, with public spending at just 12% of GDP, Latin America's lowest. Private security guards outnumber police 5-1, allowing anyone with money to outgun authorities. For criminals seeking offshore bases, government cooperation is crucial. Honduras exemplifies this as the original banana republic with easily bribed politicians. The country's police force is deeply compromised. During one purge, 150 of just 570 evaluated officers were dismissed for corruption. Following the 2009 coup, when the president was removed in his pajamas, police concentrated in the capital, leaving rural areas even less monitored. Cartels have been aggressively buying land in strategic regions. In Guatemala's northern Petén department, ownership changed at astonishing rates between 2005 to 2010. 90% of land in Sayaxche, 75% in San Jose, and 69% in La Libertad. These properties serve multiple purposes, landing strips, processing labs, training camps, while simultaneously functioning as money laundering vehicles. While modern executives like Jack Welch of GE dream of floating factories that could dock wherever conditions are most favorable, drug cartels have long operated beyond national boundaries. Colombian trafficker Carlos Leder realized the private island fantasy in 1978, establishing a Bahamian cocaine transit point years before legitimate businesses embraced offshoring. Drug cartels, like legitimate multinationals, must carefully select their operational bases. Where legitimate businesses seek strong institutions and rule of law, cartels thrive where institutions are weak. Creating a makeshift cartel competitiveness report using World Economic Forum data on factors like corruption, judicial independence, and police reliability reveals that Guatemala and Honduras offer ideal conditions for criminal enterprise. Combating cartel offshoring requires better metrics and incentives. While organizations like Transparency International track corruption perceptions, a more practical security index could measure concrete factors like police-to-population ratios, officer salaries, extradition laws, wiretapping capabilities, and gun control regulations. Publishing and tracking such security measures would create both incentives and roadmaps for countries to improve their defenses against criminal enterprises. Criminal organizations have discovered franchising as a powerful business model for rapid expansion. Like the spam email industry that profits despite minuscule response rates, extortion rackets flourish when threats appear credible, which is where cartel branding becomes valuable. Small-time extortionists need recognized brands to make their threats credible, while ambitious cartels seek cheap ways to expand. This creates a perfect match. Local thugs use cartel names to instill fear, while cartels gain additional manpower through franchise arrangements. Mexican cartels have undergone extraordinary expansion, evolving from Colombian assistance to overseeing entire drug operations. The Zetas exemplify this growth, transforming from the Gulf Cartel's enforcement arm into an independent organization with international reach, becoming the McDonald's of organized crime, with branches throughout eastern Mexico and Central America. The Zetas fuel their rapid growth through franchising rather than establishing operations from scratch. Their scouts identify promising local criminals and offer the Zetas brand as a franchise, providing military training and weapons in exchange for revenue sharing and solidarity pacts. Like McDonald's requiring franchisees to finance their own restaurants, this arrangement allows the Zetas to expand quickly without capital investment, particularly valuable for illegal businesses with limited access to credit. Franchisees bring entrepreneurial drive and local knowledge, especially valuable for forging corrupt connections with local law enforcement. The Zeta's brutal reputation serves as brand recognition, with their atrocities carefully documented and shared to strengthen their image worldwide, just as McDonald's global advertising campaigns benefit all its outlets. To protect their brand, cartels violently punish unauthorized use of their names and logos, and provide branded equipment and uniforms to legitimate franchisees. Miguel, a former Sinaloa cartel associate, operated under a license from the organization rather than as a direct employee. He would collect marijuana from mountain farmers, compress it using hydraulic pumps, and prepare it for smuggling by wrapping packages in polythene and wax to mask the smell. The Sinaloa Federation's franchise arrangement gave operators like Miguel freedom to work with their preferred farmers and set their own terms. While traditional cartels focused on controlling drug supply routes, the Zetas revolutionized the model by controlling territory instead. Their franchisees manage all criminal activity in designated areas, from drug trafficking to extortion, kidnapping, and local drug sales, sending a percentage back to headquarters. This territorial approach has made taxi drivers valuable targets for recruitment, as their vehicles provide ideal cover for moving drugs and kidnap victims. Zeta's franchises have diversified into selling Z-branded whiskey to local bars and pirated DVDs marked with their logo. Decentralized leadership means cartels sacrifice control to local managers whose mistakes can damage the entire brand. In 2011, local Zetas members murdered U.S. agent Jamie Zapata after mistaking him for a rival cartel member, breaking the unwritten rule to never kill Americans. This error triggered devastating consequences. Coordinated sweeps arrested hundreds across the U.S., while Zetas leaders Heriberto Lascano and Miguel Trevino were killed or captured in subsequent years. Despite these risks, franchising has allowed criminal organizations to expand rapidly while diversifying beyond drug trafficking. The silver lining may be that franchised organizations prove less professional than dedicated trafficking cartels. They're less adept at corrupting senior government officials and potentially simpler to pacify since their income depends on territorial control rather than smuggling. Additionally, franchisees' tendency toward infighting may ultimately unravel organizations like the Zetas, whose franchising model could be their undoing. Just as e-commerce has revolutionized legitimate retail, it's now reshaping the narcotics business. Buying drugs has traditionally been a nerve-wracking experience, hurried transactions and dark corners with terrible customer service. Online marketplaces completely transform this experience, offering professional product listings with high-resolution photos, detailed descriptions, shipping options, customer reviews, and satisfaction ratings. Two key technologies make online drug purchases possible. First, marketplaces operate on the dark web, accessible only through special browsers like Tor, which uses onion routing to create untraceable layers of encryption. Second, Bitcoin provides anonymous payment without traditional banking records. The Digital Citizens Alliance estimates illegal narcotics comprise about 2/3 of dark web listings. According to the Global Drug Survey, online drug purchasing is becoming increasingly common. 14% of American drug users and 22% of British users reported buying drugs online. While the FBI initially estimated Silk Road processed $1.2 billion during its 2.5 years online, later revised to $200 million, this remains tiny compared to the $300 billion global drug market, but comparable to eBay's early growth trajectory. Traditional drug markets operate as network economies, where deals happen secretly between connected parties. Buyers might pay inflated prices for inferior products, unaware of better options nearby. Established dealers benefit from these information asymmetries and high barriers to entry. Online marketplaces transform this dynamic by creating open markets where buyers can compare all available options and sellers compete transparently on price, quality, and service. The dark web eliminates the need for physical networks, drastically reducing barriers to entry for new dealers. Online drug dealers excel at customer service, responding promptly to inquiries and clearly outlining terms. Many offer compensation for undelivered products and use eBay-style feedback systems to build trust. Despite the criminal nature of transactions, the reputation system creates honor among thieves. Even sellers of stolen credit cards offer guarantees. This customer-centric approach represents an existential threat to traditional drug networks, as the dark web allows anyone with a laptop to compete, similar to how Uber disrupted the taxi industry. Online drug markets provide better quality assurance than traditional networks. Rather than buying from your friend's brother's girlfriend's roommate, customers can rely on thousands of reviews. Studies show drugs purchased online are typically high purity, comparable to research-grade chemicals. The FBI's test purchases from Silk Road confirm this quality. The virtual marketplace also eliminates territorial violence. No more bloody turf wars or ice cream wars like those in 1980s Glasgow. The shift to online drug markets brings mixed consequences. Prices are pushed downward as dealers save on storefront costs and face increased competition. More worryingly, online purchasing removes barriers to entry for new customers who might be deterred by sketchy contacts or dangerous neighborhoods. The process is surprisingly simple. If you can buy a book on Amazon, you can likely purchase crystal meth on the dark web. Online drug dealing presents unique challenges for law enforcement. Traditional network economies are vulnerable because breaking one link can disrupt the entire chain. Unfortunately for law enforcement, darknet marketplaces have essentially replaced these brokers with decentralized platforms where thousands of buyers and sellers interact directly. Even when sites like Silk Road are shut down, new ones quickly emerge to fill the void. As legal cannabis businesses emerge in Colorado and other states, they present the first serious market competition to drug cartels' $40 billion marijuana monopoly. Legal cannabis businesses enjoy significant competitive advantages over their black market rivals. While illegal operations must limit their scale to avoid detection, legal grows like Denver Relief can operate massive facilities with sophisticated climate control systems, specialized nutrients, and precise monitoring. Where illegal growers worry about suspicious electricity usage, limiting themselves to around 5,000 watts to avoid detection, Denver Relief uses approximately 250,000 watts between lighting and climate control systems. Legal marijuana producers also outcompete illegal suppliers through laboratory testing and quality control. Companies like CanLabs test cannabis strains for potency, contaminants, and precise cannabinoid profiles. This allows dispensaries to provide detailed information about each product's effects, duration, and purity, information illegal dealers simply cannot match. The legal market has spawned entirely new business models unavailable to illegal operators, including marijuana tourism. Peter Johnson's cannabis ventures include a pot-friendly taxi service and hotel. By 2014, Colorado had licensed 833 recreational dispensaries, serving approximately 500,000 monthly consumers. Tourism has become crucial, with 44% of Denver area sales coming from out-of-state visitors and up to 90% in mountain communities. Legalization has revolutionized cannabis consumption through professionally manufactured edibles and beverages. Over 250 licensed infused product manufacturers in Colorado have developed products impossible to find on the black market. Dixie Elixirs, the state's largest producer, operates from a 30,000-square-foot factory making cannabis-infused drinks, chocolates, and even massage oils. Market forces have pushed companies toward developing milder products rather than stronger ones, a development that terrifies cartels who cannot compete in this innovative product space. Despite legalization in only 4 states, representing just 5% of America's population, legal marijuana increasingly threatens cartels' dominance. For cartels to compete, they must beat legal growers on price. Denver Relief can produce marijuana for about $2 per gram, with other Colorado producers targeting $2.20 per gram. After taxes, legal cannabis retails for $11 to $15 in medical dispensaries and $16 to $20 in recreational outlets. Illegal Mexican pot sells for about $15 per gram but contains only 7% THC compared to Colorado's 20% strains, meaning consumers need 3 times as much Mexican product for the same effect. The Mexican Institute for Competitiveness found that smuggled cannabis from Colorado or Washington is cheaper than Mexican weed in 47 of 48 mainland states when accounting for potency. Only Texas, right on Mexico's doorstep, still favors cartel product. This threatens to slash cartels' cannabis revenues from $2 billion to $600 million. Evidence of impact already exists. Mexican police recently found 30 tons of unsold marijuana in a Tijuana warehouse, and cartels have repurposed drug tunnels for migrant smuggling, a sign they're desperate for alternative revenue sources. The cannabis industry has rapidly evolved from closet operations to a sophisticated business sector with lobby groups, PR companies, trade shows, and media coverage. Though publicly denying interest in marijuana, tobacco companies have been researching cannabis opportunities for decades. A prescient Brown and Williamson report from the 1970s imagined a scenario remarkably similar to today's gradual state-by-state legalization, predicting that eventually South America and Indonesia would become primary global suppliers due to lower production costs. This may indeed happen, as Latin American governments are increasingly dissatisfied with prohibition policies that empower cartels. Uruguay has already legalized cannabis, while former presidents of Brazil and Mexico have endorsed similar policies. Vicente Fox, Mexico's former president, has even expressed interest in turning his rancho into a cannabis farm, noting it would take millions of dollars away from criminals. If Mexico begins producing legal cannabis, Denver's warehouses might follow Detroit's car factories, undercut by cheaper foreign competition. Legalization could bring the industry full circle, from illegal Mexican production to legal U.S. production and back to Mexico, but with farmers working for Philip Morris rather than cartels. One of the most remarkable successes in the drug war occurred in Texas when officials seized $1.6 billion in drugs without firing a shot. They simply changed their accounting method from wholesale to retail prices, artificially inflating seizure values tenfold. This exemplifies how drug enforcement often demonstrates selective understanding of economics. Yet economists are increasingly analyzing crime as business, with Britain's Office for National Statistics now measuring illegal markets for drugs and sex, finding they contribute about $7.4 billion and $8.9 billion respectively to GDP, together worth more than agriculture. The war on drugs has been hampered by four major economic mistakes. First, the obsession with supply rather than demand. Disrupting coca leaf production in the Andes has minimal impact on cocaine prices because raw materials represent less than 1% of the $100,000 kilo street value. More importantly, demand for drugs is inelastic. Studies show a 10% price increase reduces marijuana consumption by only 3.3%, cocaine by 1.7%, and heroin by less than 1%. This inelasticity creates a perverse outcome. Successful enforcement raises prices but barely reduces consumption, actually increasing the total value of the criminal market. Second, governments save money early on and pay for it later. While they claim resources are scarce when it comes to prevention and rehabilitation, they spend lavishly on enforcement. New Hampshire cut $15 million from prison education and rehabilitation programs, while its small town of Keene spent $286,000 on a military-grade armored vehicle despite experiencing only 3 homicides in 13 years. This misallocation is economically irrational. Studies show that for every $1 million spent on treatment, consumption of cocaine drops by 100 kilograms, 10 times more effective than enforcement measures. Third, governments act nationally against a global business. While drug traffickers operate borderless businesses spanning continents, anti-drug efforts remain stubbornly national, creating the cockroach effect, where success in one country merely shifts the problem elsewhere. The UN has celebrated remarkable achievements when coca cultivation was pushed from Peru to Colombia in the 1990s, then back to Peru a decade later, achieving remarkably little overall change. This national myopia persists because wealthy consumer nations prefer fighting the war far from home. The United States deploys no helicopter gunships over Washington, D.C., despite disruptions being most effective at the end of the supply chain. Fourth, policymakers confuse prohibition with control. Despite the UN's 1998 slogan, "A drug-free world, we can do it," and over $1 trillion spent enforcing prohibition, consumption of marijuana and cocaine has increased by half, while opiate use has nearly tripled. Colorado's experiment shows what legal regulation might look like. Drugs tested for safety, clearly labeled, sold in limited quantities to adults, generating tax revenue, $76 million in the first year, while saving money on arrests, dropping from $30,000 to $2,000 annually. For harder drugs, limited legalization has proven even more effective. Several European countries allow doctors to prescribe heroin to addicts. Switzerland's program targeted 3,000 hardcore users who represented 10 to 15% of users, but 60% of consumption. By providing free, supervised heroin, robberies dropped 90%. More importantly, removing these heavy users, who were also dealers, simultaneously destroyed demand and supply, causing new addiction registrations in Zurich to fall from 850 in 1990 to just 150 by 2005. After half a century, the result is clear. Prohibition hasn't reduced consumption while creating a violent $300 billion global industry. Until radical change occurs, business conditions for cartels will remain promising. The solution lies not in more enforcement, but in smarter economics, addressing demand rather than supply, investing in prevention rather than punishment, coordinating globally rather than nationally, and regulating rather than prohibiting.